With the men at the rear of the column was Captain Steele. His overriding goal was to consolidate his Ranger force and reestablish some order. He had just heard on the radio that Durant's Black Hawk had gone down. As he arrived at an intersection, Steele moved over the slight rise and started down the hill. He had gone only about 10 yards when a burst of fire forced him and those with him to drop. He was on his belly, with his wide face nearly in the sand. Alongside to his left was Sergeant Chris Atwater, his radio man. Prone to Atwater's left was Lieutenant Lechner, Steele's second in command. Atwater and Steele, both big men, were trying to take cover behind a tree with a trunk only about 1 foot wide. About 3 strides to their right, Sergeant Hooten was in a steel doorway to the small courtyard where Bullock had dragged Goodale. Steele was watching another team of operators working their way up the street ahead of him. He intended to follow, but just then one of the D-boys, Fillmore, went limp. His little plastic helmet jerked up and back and blood came spouting out of his head. It was obviously fatal. Fillmore just crumpled. An operator grabbed Fillmore and began dragging him into a narrow alley. That soldier was shot in the neck. Steele felt the gravity of their predicament hit fully home. This is for keeps. Sergeant Hooten, in the doorway to a courtyard about 10 feet to Steele's right, tried to get the captain's attention. What Hooten was trying to tell Steele was that he'd chosen a bad place to stop. Fillmore and one of the other operators had just been shot in that spot. A bullet sprayed sand into Steele's eyes. Lechner thought the shot came from across the road, but Steele rolled to his right and looked at the tin wall behind him. 2 more holes poked through the tin with loud bangs and dirt flew, and Lechner screamed. Steele was already rolling when he heard Lechner scream. There was more shooting. Hooten gesticulated wildly in the doorway, waving Steele in. Steele got up and ran for it. Atwater came flying in after him. Steele saw Atwater and shouted, "We've got to get Lechner!" Steele stood to run back out to get Lechner, but saw the howling lieutenant being dragged toward the door by Bullock, who had run out to the street to help. Sergeant Goodale, who had been pulled into the same courtyard earlier after being shot through the thigh and buttock, had heard Lechner howl. Now here the lieutenant was, screaming in agony. The upper part of his right leg normal, but the bottom half just below the knee flopped grotesquely to one side. Blood flowed from Lechner's wound like it was pouring from a jug. Up in their Black Hawk, Gafina and Yacone could see both convoys in trouble. Lieutenant Colonel McKnight's battered main convoy was steering back toward the K4 circle, away from both crash sites, and the emergency convoy of cooks and volunteers wasn't getting close. They asked to insert their Delta snipers. Sergeant First Class Randy Shugart and Master Sergeant Gary Gordon indicated they were ready to go down. Up in the command bird, Harrell and Matthews pondered the request. Shugart and Gordon were experts at killing and staying alive. Dropping them in would most likely be sending them to their deaths. But so long as there was even a tiny chance, Harrell and Matthews felt obliged to give it to the downed crew. When Gafina's crew chief passed word to the men that it was time to jump, Gordon grinned and gave an excited thumbs up. There was a small opening behind one of the huts. Gafina held a hover at about 5 feet as Shugart and Gordon jumped. At roughly the same time, 1.5 miles southwest, his helicopter pancaked into a squalid village of cloth and tin huts. Black Hawk Super 6-4 pilot Mike Durant came too. He and his co-pilot Ray Frank had been knocked cold for at least several minutes. The dazed pilots checked themselves over. The impact had broken Durant's femur. The big bone in his right leg had snapped on the edge of his seat. Frank's left tibia was broken. They both figured they had crushed vertebrae. The windshield was shattered, and there was something draped over Durant, a big sheet of tin, but the Black Hawk seemed remarkably intact. It had flattened a flimsy hut. No one had been inside, but in the hut alongside, a 2-year-old girl, Hawa Hassan, lay unconscious and bleeding. A hunk of flying metal from the helicopter had taken a deep gouge out of her forehead. Her mother, Bint Abraham Hassan, had been splashed with something hot, probably oil, and was severely burned on her face and legs. Durant realized that with his leg and back broken, he would be unable to pull himself out of the chopper. He pushed the piece of tin roof away from him and resolved to defend his position through the broken windshield. Durant remembers seeing Frank sitting in the doorway opposite, about to push himself out. It was the last time he saw him. That's when Shugart and Gordon showed up. Durant didn't know either of the Delta operators well, but seeing them gave him an enormous sense of relief. It was over. He figured they were part of a rescue team. Shugart and Gordon were calm. The D-boys reached in and lifted Durant out of the craft gently, one lifting his legs and the other grabbing his torso, as if they had all the time in the world, and set him down on his side by a tree. He was not in great pain. With the airframe and a wall joined behind him, and a wall to his left that ran all the way back behind the tail of the chopper, Durant was in a perfect position to cover the whole right side of the aircraft. He could see that his crew chiefs had taken the brunt of the impact. He watched the operators lift Bill Cleveland from the fuselage. Cleveland had blood all over his pants and was talking, but making no sense. Then the D-boys moved to the other side of the helicopter to help his crew chief, Tommy Field. Skinnies were starting to poke their heads around the corner on Durant's side of the chopper. He'd squeeze off around and they'd drop back behind cover. He could hear more and more shooting now from the other side of the airframe. It still hadn't occurred to him that these two D-boys were it, and that there was no rescue team. On each of his passes over the wreck, Mike Gufina in Super 6-2 found the encircling mob larger. Shugart and Gordon had arrayed themselves and the chopper crew in a perimeter around the downed bird. They were dug in and awaiting help. On the radio, Gufina could hear the desperate problems the rescue convoys were having. The battle was at its most confusing point. There were now two crash sites. A rescue team had made it to the first, Cliff Walcott's, and the entire assault force and original ground convoy had been directed to move there. A second hastily assembled rescue convoy had left the Ranger base and not gotten far. They were probing around the vicinity of Durant's crash site, but not getting close. The first crash site had a fighting chance, but Durant's, even with the two D-boys they dropped in, wouldn't last long without more help. Gufina flew a low orbit over Durant's downed Blackhawk. Every time he swung west, he was blinded by the sun. He wished it would hurry up and set. He and the other Night Stalkers felt most comfortable flying at night. In the darkness, with their technology, the chopper pilots and crew could see while the enemy could not. If Gufina's Blackhawk and the Little Birds could hold off the mob until nightfall, the men on the ground had a chance. The mob below now filled all footpaths back out to the main road. He could see RPGs flying past his helicopter very plainly. He saw one of the D-boys get shot. On one of his turns back into the slowly setting sun, Gufina's helicopter collided with what felt like a freight train, a resounding crash. It felt like the sky had caved. Gufina realized he had been hit by an RPG on the right side. Captain Yacone, Gufina's co-pilot, hung limp in his seat. Gufina didn't know if Yacone was dead or just injured. They were aloft, but going down fast. He saw a street below, an alley, really. If he could keep the bird heading toward that alley, they might be able to slide down into it. Yacone came back to life and shouted into the radio that they were going down and gave grid coordinates. As they cushioned themselves for impact, Gufina began instinctively pulling back on his control stick, trying to keep the nose of the bird up. And he realized suddenly that the helicopter was responding. It wasn't dead. He had no idea how long they would stay up, but the bird stayed fairly level, and the power stayed on. The road beneath them abruptly ended, and what opened in front of him in the distance was what Gufina recognized as the new port facility, Friendly Ground. He crossed low over the fence around the port and aimed the bird down. Mike Durant still thought things were under control. His leg was broken, but it didn't hurt. He was lying on his back, propped against a supply kit by a small tree. He could hear firing over on the other side of the helicopter. He knew Ray Frank, his co-pilot, was hurt, but alive. And there were the two D-boys and his crew chief, Tommy Field. He wondered if Tommy was okay. Then he heard one of the operators cry out that he was hit. It was Gary Gordon. The other one, Randy Shugart, came back to Durant's side of the bird. "Are there weapons on board?" he asked. There were. The crew chiefs carried M-16s. Duran told him where they were kept, and Shugart stepped into the craft and rummaged around and returned with both. He handed Durant Gordon's weapon, a Kar-15, loaded and ready to fire. "What's the support frequency on the survival radio?" Shugart asked. It was then, for the first time, that it dawned on Durant that they were stranded. Shugart and Gordon were the rescue team, and Gordon had just been shot. Durant explained standard procedure on the survival radio to Shugart. Shugart called and was told that a reaction force was en route. Then Shugart wished Durant luck, took the weapons, and moved back around to the other side of the helicopter. Durant felt panicked now. He had to keep the skinnies away. A man tried to climb over the wall, and Durant shot him. There came a mad fusillade on the other side of the helicopter that lasted for about 2 minutes. Over the din, he heard Shugart cry out in pain. Then it stopped. Terror washed over Durant. He heard the sounds of an angry mob. The crash had left the clearing littered with debris, and he heard a great shuffling sound as the mob pushed it away like some onrushing beast. There was no more shooting. The others must be dead. Durant knew what angry Somali mobs could do, gruesome, horrible things. That was now in store for him. His second weapon was empty. He still had a pistol strapped to his side, but he never even thought to reach for it. Why bother? It was over. He was done. A man stepped around the nose of the plane. He seemed startled to find Durant. The man shouted, and more skinnies came racing around. It was time to die. Durant placed the empty weapon across his chest, folded his hands over it, and just turned his eyes to the sky. Hassan Yassin Abukoy had been shot in the ankle as he stood with the crowd around the crashed helicopter. He hated the helicopters. His uncle, that day, had his head blown off by a cannon shot from a helicopter. Who were these Americans who rained fire and death on them, who came to feed them, but then had started killing? He wanted to kill these men who had fallen from the sky, but he couldn't stand. From where he sat, Abukoy could see the mob descend on the Americans. Only one was still alive. He was shouting and waving his arms as the mob grabbed him by the legs and began pulling him away from the helicopter, tearing at his clothes. He saw his neighbors hack at the bodies of the Americans with knives and begin to pull at their limbs. Then he saw people running and parading with parts of the Americans' bodies. When Moalim got to the neighborhood where the second helicopter had crashed, the paths leading toward it were already littered with bodies. There were choppers shooting from above, and, as Moalim had expected, there were still Americans around the crash capable of fighting. Moalim kept trying to hold the crowd back, but they were angry and brazen. When Moalim ran around the tail of the helicopter, he was surprised to find another American, a pilot. The man did not shoot. He set his weapon on his chest and folded his hands over it. The crowd surged past Moalim toward him and began kicking and beating him. But Moalim felt suddenly protective. He grabbed the pilot's arm and fired his weapon in the air and shouted for the crowd to stay back. One of his men struck the pilot hard in the face with his rifle butt, and Moalim pushed him back. The pilot was injured and could not fight anymore. The Rangers had spent months capturing Somalis and holding them prisoner. They would be willing to trade them, perhaps all of them, for one of their own. The pilot was more valuable alive than dead. He directed his men to form a ring around the pilot to protect him from the mob, which was hungry for revenge. Several of Moalim's men stooped and began tearing Durant's clothing away. The pilot had a pistol strapped to his side and a knife, and they were afraid he had other hidden weapons. They also knew the American pilots wore beacons in their clothing, so that the helicopters could track them, so they stripped the layers away. Durant kept his eyes on the sky as the mob closed over him. He gave himself over to them. His boots were yanked off, his survival vest, and his shirt. A man half unzipped his pants, but when he saw that Durant wore no underwear, he zipped the trousers back up. They also left on his brown t-shirt. All the while, he was being kicked and hit. A young man leaned down and grabbed the green ID card Durant wore around his neck. He stuck it in Durant's face and shouted, "Ranger! Ranger, you die, Somalia!" They tied a rag or towel over the top of his head and eyes, and the mob hoisted him up in the air, partly carrying and partly dragging him. He felt the broken end of his femur pierce the skin in the back of his leg and poke through. He was buffeted from all sides, kicked, hit with fists, rifle butts. He was engulfed in a great wave of hate and anger. And in this agony of fright, suddenly Durant left his body. He was no longer at the center of the crowd. He was in it, or above it, perhaps. He was observing the crowd attacking him, apart somehow. And he felt no pain, and the fear lessened, and then he passed out. The Alamo. At the first crash site, Air Force parajumper Tim Wilkinson climbed back into the wrecked helicopter, looking for a way to get more leverage to free pilot Cliff Walcott's body. But it was hopeless. He climbed back out. Kneeling on top of the wreck in the shattering din of automatic weapons fire, he peered down through the open right side doors into the rear of the aircraft. All the avionics equipment and every piece of gear that hadn't been strapped down had come to rest at the left side of the aircraft, which was now the bottom. In the heap, he noticed a scrap of desert fatigues. "I think there's somebody else in there," he told Sergeant Bob Mabry, a Delta medic. Wilkinson climbed back into the wreckage and began pulling the debris and equipment off the man buried there. It was the second crew chief, Ray Dowdy. He was only half conscious. Just as Wilkinson freed Dowdy, Mabry crawled in through the upper doors. The three men stood inside the wreck as a storm of bullets suddenly poked through the skin of the craft. Mabry and Wilkinson danced involuntarily at the sharp burst of snapping and crashing noises. Bits of metal, plastic, paper, and fabric flew around them like a sudden snow squall. Then it stopped. Wilkinson checked himself. He had been hit in the face and arm. It felt like he had been slapped or punched in the chin. Everyone had been hit. Mabry had been hit in the hand. Dowdy had lost the tips of two fingers. Instead of braving the fire above, they tunneled out, digging through the dry sand at the rear corner of the left side door. They slid Dowdy out that way. The American forces around Wolcott's downed Black Hawk were now scattered along an L-shaped perimeter. One group of about 30 men was massed around the wreck in the alleyway. When they learned that the ground convoy had gotten lost and delayed, they began moving the wounded through the hole made by the falling helicopter into the house of Abdiaziz Ali Aden, who was still hidden in a back room. At the west end of the alley, at the bend of the L, was the intersection with the wide street named Marahan Road, where on one corner Nelson, Urick, Barton, and Twombly were dug in. On another corner of the intersection were Di Tommaso and four others. The rest of the ground force was stretched out south on Marahan Road. A block and a half uphill from the intersection, Steele and a dozen or so Rangers, along with three Delta teams, about 30 men in all, were together in a courtyard. Sergeant Howe's Delta team, with a group of Rangers that included Specialist Stebbins, followed by the Delta Command Group led by Captain Miller, had already gone farther down Marahan Road and was moving down the west wall to the intersection. Across from Howe, Lieutenant Perino was moving downhill along the east wall with Corporal Smith, Sergeant Chuck Elliott, and several other men. As Howe approached Nelson's position at the intersection, it looked to him as though the Rangers were just hiding. Howe's team members helped arrange Nelson and the others to set up effective fields of fire, and placed Stebbins and machine gunner Private Brian Hurd at a corner of the same intersection. Captain Miller caught up with Howe, and with all the shooting at that intersection, Howe decided it was time to get off the street. There was a metal gate at the entrance of the courtyard between two buildings on his side of Marahan Road. Howe and another soldier began hurling themselves against the gate, which gave way. Howe plunged into the courtyard and rapidly moved through the house on either side, running from room to room. He was looking for people, focusing his eyes at mid-torso first, checking hands. The hands told you the whole story. The only hands he found were empty. They belonged to a man and woman and some children, a family of about seven, clearly terrified. The family was flex-cuffed and herded into a small side room. Howe then more carefully inspected the space. Each of the blocks in this neighborhood of Mogadishu consisted of mostly one-story stone houses grouped irregularly around open spaces or courtyards. This block consisted of a short courtyard, about 2 car lengths wide, where he now stood. There was a 2-story house on the south side and a 1-story house on the north. The one-story house was on the corner of the intersection where he had placed Stebbins and Hurd. Hal figured this space was about the safest spot around. The taller building would shelter them from both bullets and lobbed RPGs. In the one-story house on the corner, Hal moved from room to room, looking for windows that would give them a good vantage for shooting down the alley, the same one that the helicopter had crashed into one block over. He could only see about 15 yards down in either direction, and all he saw was wall. When he returned to the courtyard, Captain Miller and the others had begun herding casualties into the space. It would serve as their Delta command post and casualty collection point for the rest of the night. As Hal re-entered the courtyard, one of the master sergeants with Captain Miller told him to get back out to the street and help his team. Hal resented the order. He felt he was, at this point, the de facto leader on the ground, the one doing all the real thinking and moving and fighting. They had reached a temporary safe point, a time for commanders to catch their breath and think. The next step would be to look for ways to strong point their position and expand their perimeter. The troop sergeant's command was the order of a man who didn't know what to do next. Hal was built like a pro wrestler, but he was a thinker. He saw the big picture very clearly, better than most. He was furious. He began gathering up ammo, grenades, and light anti-tank weapons off the wounded Rangers in the courtyard. It seemed to Hal that most of the men failed to grasp how desperate their situation had become. They were surrounded and terribly outnumbered. He stomped angrily out to the street and began looking for Somalis to shoot. He found one of the Rangers, Nelson, firing a handgun at the window of the building Hal had just painstakingly cleared and occupied. Nelson had seen someone moving in the window, and they had been taking fire from just about every direction, so he was pumping a few rounds that way. Hal shouted across the alley, "What are you doing?" Nelson couldn't hear Hal. He shouted back, "I saw someone in there. No shit! There are friendlies in there!" Nelson didn't find out until later what Hal had been waving his arms about. When he did, he was mortified. No one had told him that Delta had moved into that space. Already furious, Hal began venting at the Rangers. He felt that they were not fighting hard enough. When he saw Nelson, Urick, and the others trying to selectively target armed Somalis in a crowd at the other end of a building, Hal threw a grenade over its roof. He then watched the Rangers try to hit a gunman who kept darting out from behind a shed about one block north, shooting and then retreating back behind it. The Delta sergeant flung one of his golf ball-sized mini-grenades over the Rangers' position. It exploded behind the shed, and the gunman did not reappear. Everything about this situation was pissing Hal off. The goddamn Somalis, his leaders, the idiot Rangers, even his ammunition. He drew a bead on three Somalis who were running across the street two blocks to the north. He was an expert marksman, and he thought he had hit them, but he couldn't tell for sure because they kept running until they crossed the street and were out of view. It bugged him. His weapon was the most sophisticated infantry rifle in the world, a customized Kar 15, and he was shooting the Army's new 5.56mm green tip round. The green tip had a tungsten carbide penetrator at the tip that would punch holes in metal, but that very penetrating power meant his rounds were passing right through his targets. Hal felt like he had to hit a guy five or six times just to get his attention. You shoot a guy, you want to see him go down. You don't want to be guessing for the next 5 hours whether you hit him or whether he's still waiting for you in the weeds. Still, Hal was in a good spot on Marahan Road. There was nothing in front or behind him that would stop a bullet, but there was a tree about 20 feet south that blocked any view of him from that direction. The bigger tree across the intersection with the crash site alley, where Nelson, Twombly, and the others were positioned, blocked any view of him from the north. So the broad-beamed Delta sergeant could kneel about 5 feet off the wall and pick off targets to the north with impunity. It was like that in battle. Some spots were safer than others. When Hal saw Perino, Smith, and Elliot creeping down to a similar position on the other side of the street, he figured they were trying to do what he was doing. Except on that side of the street, there were no trees to provide concealment. He shouted across at them impatiently, but in the din, he wasn't heard.